to Comic Talk Today for Monday, July 2nd, 2018. And this is the episode of the week I like to call the Top of the Pile. Of course, the Top of the Pile, I will talk about some of my favorite reads from last week's New Comic Book Day. This week, I have, I think, 9 books that I want to talk about. Probably won't go very much in depth into some of them, and I may bring up a few more along the way. This week is, of course, a national holiday week. July 4th is on Wednesday, the Day of Independence for the United States. Some people will take the day off. I will not be taking the day off. There will be an episode on the 4th. In fact, there will be an episode every day this week. The difference is that this week I was going to do a rant on Wednesday, and there's a couple things that definitely I want to rant about. Fortunately, I have a very interesting guest coming with me on Thursday, so all the ranting will be done on Thursday for Therapy Thursday with my secret guest. And when you learn who it is, some of you will be very surprised that I'm hanging out with this person on the show. But I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm very excited to talk to this person. And you'll find out who it is on Thursday. Now, let's get on to the comics. And first up on the list is Pestilence, the Story of Satan number 2, Frank Thierry, Oleg Okunev. So I tweeted about this. Here's the thing, folks. I love this book. Okay, you guys know this. If you listen to this podcast, you know whenever a Pestilence book comes out, I usually recommend it or I talk about it on Top of the Pile. I was very excited to read this last week. I know I've already recorded an Aftershock Central podcast with Ronnie. We talked about it in depth, but I need to make an apology. I apologized on Twitter yesterday when I was doing the comics I like to read tweets that I usually do on Saturdays or Sundays. And here's the thing. This is not an issue for the children. If you have children around you, put your headphones on. That was your warning. This book is definitely not for the children, guys. There's some definite, I'm trying to think how I want to word this. Even though you already took your kids out of the room, you put your headphones on, whatever it is, there is a lot of zombie demon butt sex in this issue. And I know some of you will be a little taken aback by that. Maybe you're a little concerned that I'm kicking off this issue of Top of the Pile talking about this kind of thing. But it is what it is. That's what's in the book. And, you know, if you're not into that kind of thing, I know some of you are very against that kind of stuff in your comics. I totally understand. But I gotta say, I really love this issue with those scenes in there and aside from those scenes in there. With issue 2, I think Frank has really kicked the story up a notch quite a bit. We saw that Satan was kind of be a part of the story in the first issue. With the second issue, he becomes a central part of the story. And I'm curious to know how things are going to go from here. Because, of course, this book still has a few issues to go. And with the level of craziness that happened in this second issue, I don't know. Some people may drop this book. It might not be for the faint of heart. I'm going to say that. But I think I thoroughly enjoyed it, and part of the reason I really liked it is because Oleg's art really, really, really sets the tone for the type of story that this is. And even the really wacky and kooky and crazy stuff, the sexual stuff, it's all done extremely well, and it's beautiful to look at. So if you can get past it, and I hope you can, I think you really dig this issue. In fact, even the very explicit scenes towards the end of the book, I think are extremely telling and revealing about what this world is about and who this one character is that's involved in this scene. So really, really interesting. I think I really dug that whole thing. Of course, I had a lot of chuckles when I was reading it because, you know, sometimes those kind of things make people uncomfortable, right? When I talked to Ronnie about it, I think we went on for about 15, 20 minutes talking about this book and maybe threw in some crass jokes in there. Not on purpose, but they kind of ended up being that way. But I think this book is fantastic. So if you're okay with reading mature work, and I hope you are, because I think it can be done in a way where it makes sense to the story. And, you know, some people don't like the gratuitous sex stuff, and I totally understand that. But I think in this issue, it was not gratuitous at all, and it really works well with the story. So Pestilence, the Story of Satan, this is from Aftershock Comics. Issue 2, for me, was a 5 out of 5. I loved it. I really, really loved it. I love this book. I think Frank really kicks it up a notch with every single issue. And I mean, this is volume 2 of the book, right? So we've had 6 or 7 issues of this already. and to kick a story up a notch each and every time is just absolutely exciting. So pick this one up if you're a horror fan, if you're a Frank Thierry fan. I mean, the guy's pretty funny. He's very crass, but he's very funny. So highly, highly recommended. Pestilence, A Story of Satan number 2 from Aftershock Comics, again, is a 5 out of 5. Let's go from there to Shadow Roads. This is Shadow Roads number 1 from Oni Press. We've got Cullen Bunn, Brian Hurt, AC Zamudio, and Carlos Zamudio doing work on this book. And I was very excited for this because, as all of you are well aware, one of my favorite books out now, which is, of course, no longer out, was Harrow County. And that just finished, and this came out the same day as Harrow County. So it was a nice bookend for me to have one Cullen Bunn series end and one Cullen Bunn series begin, in particular when he does this kind of horror-type story. And Shed Roads is very interesting. The first issue, I think, was a lot of setup. And I was talking to Mike Myers about this from Mike Gibbs Weekly Reads and Geek Brunch Retrocast and Geek Brunch. Because I posted about this on Twitter, and, you know, I asked, why aren't more people talking about this? Why aren't more people reading it? And he said that this first issue was the same material that was released on Free Comic Book Day. And I thought that was interesting, and maybe that's something that I'll talk about at some point. I prefer when Free Comic Book Day stories are not the first issue of something. Okay? And I understood what Mike's point was about why he likes it better. I think what I want is the additional story. So a Free Comic Book Day book, to me, shouldn't be the first issue of a story. It should be like a zero issue or like a prologue issue or something like that, where not something like that boring, right? Because I think some of the zero issues do tend to be boring sometimes. But I want something that's related to the story, that introduces me to some of these characters, and that like end with a bang, right? So I'm like, okay, this series, like, it looks awesome. Let me go pick this up. Shadow Roads number 1 was apparently a reprint of the Free Comic Book Day stuff. That's fine. I did not pick this up on Free Comic Book Day, so I was very excited to see this when it came out. And it's a mix of different genres, and I think it's really interesting. It's set in the, I'm going to assume, late 1800s. At most, early 1900s. I don't think there's a specific date given, but based on the clothing, based on the settings that are prevalent here, I would say late 1800s. Much of the book takes place in the United States, in the West. So this would be, I would assume, right after the Gold Rush. That's why I said late 1800s. Definitely after Civil War. But none of that is really specified. Now, there are quite a few characters introduced, and it looks like the book itself will follow, I would say, 6 characters, all 6 of which are on the cover, and each of them get introduced in pairs, which I thought was really nice, because it also helps you see different parts of this world, right? And basically what the book is there are places around the world where the line between our realm and this weird magical realm is very thin, and there's already a couple of people, a group, fighting whatever invades this world through these cracks, and it looks like they're trying to recruit some more people. And our main character is Native American, which I thought was really cool. We do see a lot about the racial history of what happened to Native Americans, especially out in Europe, where, you know, at this time it was a big thing to talk about the noble savage, right? And so there's this guy who's a Native American who went to Cambridge, so he's extremely educated. But for the typical white person in Europe, he was just another Native American, a dark-skinned guy, you know. And he talks about this a little bit with his ward as they're on a train. They're like, you know, to these people, you know, I went to Cambridge, but I'm just another noble savage, right? It plays upon a lot about that because he's going to this museum exhibit, and the guy that runs the museum calls himself like Chief James or something, and he's an old white man, old fat white man with a beard, and he walks around with like a feathered hat and stuff, you know. It seems like he doesn't care too much about it because he has, of course, left the United States and tries to better himself and not just be stuck in a reservation or whatever. And obviously he succeeded because he's very well dressed, he's very smart, and he's got a ward, so, you know, I would assume he's done well for himself. But he does want to maybe reconnect with his heritage a little bit. And in this museum, he gets approached by this random strange woman, an old strange woman. And it looks to me like maybe she was wearing more traditional Native American dress. But I couldn't really tell. She was wearing a shawl. And she gives him a dagger. And as it turns out, this dagger is important because as they're heading back, and they are on the train, they go through this tunnel, the dagger starts lighting up, and demons start popping out of things, or maybe zombie demon things. And that's when we meet a couple of the other characters who are already on the hunt for these creatures, and they tell him all about it. And as it turns out, this train tunnel that they went through was one of these places where the worlds are kind of very thin, and demons can get through. And of course, they want to, you know, stop him. That's when he learns that this dagger that he had is not some random dagger, but it's actually really special. And it's made out of bone. It's got these intricate carvings on it. And it protected him from this attack. Meanwhile, back in the Western United States, we get to meet a couple of other characters who are gunslingers, who are outlaws, and they're trying to, the one guy is trying to recruit this woman who's a famous gunslinger in order to get revenge on something that happened in his past. We don't know exactly what the deal was, but somehow the person he wants to get revenge on is the same person who hurt this woman. And part of the reason why she has kind of gone into this little sleepy town in the middle of nowhere to escape from the world. So they're going to get together. As it turns out, when the train comes out of the tunnel, they end up somewhere in the Western United States as well. And it looks like they'll be pretty close by based on the landscapes and the scenery. And of course, it would be kind of almost the ancestral homeland of our main character, because when he received this dagger, the woman told him, you need to go home. And apparently this may be home. So really interesting. Again, there's a lot of setup, but if you love Western stories, I recommend you pick this up. I'm not sure how much horror will be in this book. I think maybe after Harrow County, Cullen maybe wants to step the horror back a little bit, but there's definitely some horror elements in here. There's like magical, mythological stuff, and of course the Western. I mean, I love Western stuff. I don't think there's nearly enough Western-themed comics and movies and TV shows nowadays, so it's nice to see that here. Shadow Roads number one from Oni Press is going to be a 4 out of 5. Let's go from there to Harbinger Wars 2, number 2, from Valiant Comics. This is Matt Kent, Tomas Giorello, Diego Rodriguez, and Renato Guedes. And this is, of course, the big summer blockbuster event from Valiant Comics. And unlike other big summer blockbuster events, this one's only a 4-issue miniseries, which is very cool. I'm surprised there were no tie-in books. I guess maybe just that's not the way the schedule's working out right now. This is basically a continuation of the first issue, and I think I like this one much, much better than I did the first. I was not very impressed with the first issue. I'm not sure why, what it was. I think there were some pacing problems, but this issue definitely kicked it up quite a bit. The art is absolutely gorgeous here. I really love Renato Guedes' art. And I know there's a couple of artists on here. Tomas and Renato, I think, have similar art styles in some ways. And because of that, It's almost hard in some places to tell who the artist is. And the art style is very rendered, it's beautiful to look at. It is. It's very lifelike in many ways. Matter of fact, I think there's like the second page or the third page, we see one of the runaway Saiyan kids, who has these tentacles starting to grow out of his head. And when you see his face, it's like he must have just taken this straight out of a picture, because it looks so lifelike. It's beautiful. The majority of the book, though, follows Peter Stanchek, who is, of course, kind of the team leader of the Harbingers back in the day. He's one of the most powerful Saiyans in the world, and they're pretty much after him. So a lot of the book has to do with Peter and Charlie Palmer, who's a member of the Hardcore, who's hunting these Saiyans. Kind of Palmer chasing Peter through the desert. And there's some nice emotional scenes, in particular when Peter starts using his powers in order to get into Palmer's mind. And, you know, I've always thought that Palmer was kind of a jerk, but seeing some of these flashback scenes really cements to me that Charlie Palmer is a total D-bag, and it's all his fault, right? Because we see some stuff where, like, he would be overseas in, like, Iraq or, like, out in the Southeast Asian region. And, you know, he'll have some emotional moments, like he'll want to save this woman that he was maybe sleeping with during his covert operations. But that night, you know, the village is going to get destroyed by his team. He's like, listen, you need to come with me because we're going to kill your whole village tonight. And she's like, no, I'm not leaving. And he's like, well, please, like, you know, he starts crying. Like, it's very emotional, but it doesn't matter, right? Because ultimately he's a government man. He's a company man. And so he still goes through with the mission and hurts a lot of people, hurts couples. He hurts kids. He hurts women. And, he's not a very nice person, even though we do get those little tender moments. Of course, this is all a projection, and Ninjak, who is trained in like the psychic arts when he was with the Bleeding Monk, or not the Bleeding Monk, the whatever he was called, the Sleeping Monk, back in the day during his training, he can see past some of these psychic projections, and gets Palmer out of it, kind of. This is when Exo Manowar and Peter Stanchek start duking it out. Peter has extreme power, and of course he can get through the armor's defenses, and in fact starts kind of melting the armor off of Eric, which I thought was really interesting, until Ninja comes in with one of these Sayat ability dampening helmets, and they're able to capture Peter and take him away. So, really interesting story, not a whole lot of Livewire. I wish there was more of that. We do see her with Divinity in one page. He may play a part of this at some point. I don't know, but he's kind of, he doesn't like to enter any of these conflicts, right? Because of the amount of power he has. So we may not see him, but, there was some cool stuff with Bloodshot in here. Bloodshot's got some new abilities, including the power to sprout giant bat wings, which was interesting. Of course, he's got these nanites going through his blood, so I guess it makes sense that they could be reprogrammed to do certain things. But it seemed, I don't know. I don't know if I was a big fan of that whole thing. It was great to look at. Great to look at when they pop out and when they pop in. And it's obviously very painful when this happens to him, but I don't know how will it work for me, you know? I really don't. Overall, though, I think this issue was much, much stronger. I'm curious to know about this octopus-headed kid and what his role is in this whole thing. The final page is a giant reveal. Bloodshot is going through this compound, and when he gets to the final door, he sees somebody in there that I was not expecting. But I thought that was interesting, and I want to know how that plays into this whole Harbinger Wars series. Overall, pretty good, though. I'm going to give this one a 3 out of 5. Let's segue there onto a Marvel book from an ex-Valiant writer. This is The Sentry Number 1 by Jeff Lemire, Kim Jacinto, and Rain Barreto. And I'm not sure how much of the story has already been told. I like The Sentry as a character, but I haven't read everything with The Sentry. Some of the stuff is really convoluted because he's one of these characters that was kind of retconned into history. You know, like he didn't exist back in the 60s, but when he appeared in the, I guess, early 2000s, a lot of his backstory was retconned as like a Golden Age or Silver Age hero. And, you know, there were these memories that he had that maybe other people didn't have of him. And we assume some of that is true. Maybe some of it isn't. Don't know. But this plays a lot on that. And one thing that I said when I did the Comic Predictor last week is I was a little concerned that Jeff Lemire would do kind of a Moon Knight thing with the Sentry, right? Because the Sentry does have this second personality in the Void, which is like the evil Sentry that lives inside him. And he does come out at times and causes a lot of havoc. But that wasn't the case at all, and I thought the way that this was introduced was very interesting. This book is really about Bob. It's all about Bob. And who is Bob? Bob is the Sentry. Bob Reynolds. He's almost like on this probation program that's being run by Misty Knight. Yes, Misty Knight from Luke Cage. And I love the way that she was done here, by the way. Although a couple panels bothered me because, like, when she's introduced, you get to see her, like, real up close. I would say, like, maybe 4 or 5 different panels, and like 4 out of those 5 panels, she's doing the Wakanda Forever thing, and I didn't understand why. I don't know if that was done on purpose or what it is. It didn't make sense to what was going on, but maybe I just read it wrong. I don't know. Maybe Kim Jacinto really likes Black Panther. I don't know, but I thought that was interesting. I did like the interaction though. So Bob is pretty much in a probation program, right? And every 24 hours, he needs to go back home and get into this machine, kind of live through his, emotional trauma to keep the void at bay. Some of that stuff is really interesting because we get to see a lot of characters that are similar to the Sentry, like the Sentinel, Watchdog, the Sentress. They go into this Sentry world, okay, and that's actually the title of this issue, Sentry World. They go into this non-existent world that lives inside of the Sentry's head. And I think Doctor Strange created this, is what they talk about it on here. I don't remember when this happened. I'm assuming during a big event at some point. I don't know. I don't remember. And so that he goes into this realm in his mind where the void has been trapped. And him and all these Sentry counterparts go in and start fighting the Sentry's dark forces. They try to figure out where the Sentry is. It turns out in this story he's in the moon. So the Sentry goes to the moon, blows it up to let the void out, and immediately just rips the void to shreds pretty much. And that's part of his whole therapy session is, right? So he lets the void out, he destroys the void, and the clock resets back to 24 hours. So every 24 hours, he needs to be at home and go into this place. And outside of that, he lives a pretty normal life. He's a cook at a diner and doesn't really do much. He looks like he's a little out of shape. He's got a dad bod, hashtag dad bod. And it works pretty well. I like the interaction that he's got with some of the characters. I like how he's dealing with this whole thing. And much of the book deals with the fact of, you know, if I can't control my powers, I can't be a superhero kind of thing. And I like when those stories are told. And I like that Jeff Lemire is the character to do it, or the writer to do it, because he does tell those stories pretty well. So I really enjoyed this one much more than I was expecting. I'm, again, a little confused about some of the backstory because I'm not all filled into the Sentry's backstory. But I think this first issue worked out really well for me. And this is only a 5-issue miniseries, but I'm very excited to read the rest of it. And I think Jeff Lemire is the right person to do this. And my fears were set aside when I read this issue because I'm glad we're not going the Moon Knight route. At least not yet. At least from this first issue, that was not the case. So Sentry number 1 from Marvel Comics is going to be a 4 out of 5. Let's move from there to DC. I'm going to jump around today. DC Comics. Batman Detective Comics number 983. This is a brand new arc with a brand new writer. So on here we've got Brian Edward Hill, whose stuff I really love. He does, he's been doing a lot of stuff around Top Cow, so like Cyber Force, for example. He is also doing the Wildstorm Michael Cray over at DC. And I really enjoyed this first issue. We have a new villain introduced. His name is Karma. I'll talk about Karma here in a few. But much of the story revolves around Duke Thomas. And I know some of you really don't like Duke, and I understand why you don't like Duke. But lucky for you, Karma also does not like Duke and tries to assassinate him. So I like the overall story of this. Social media plays a key role in this issue, and I'm assuming in this whole arc. As we kick off, we get to meet Darren Griffith, who is a YouTuber. In this world, it's a VTuber. And he's got a channel with like 1.5 million followers. And he's never met Batman or any of the Bat family, but he does videos related to Batman and how, you know, he changes the world. He's the self-proclaimed biggest Batman fan in the world. And he's doing a news interview. It looks like Karma may be watching the interview. He breaks a TV. Then we flash forward to a week later with Duke doing some crime fighting, and he got a hint that this guy was kidnapped. So he goes to this house, and the kid is sitting on a chair. He's roped around him, and he's got a sign on that says, "Follow this." And you see in the background, this guy says, "I'm sorry, but you're making him weaker." And the whole building explodes. Duke gets tossed out. And he's in very dire condition. Alfred's taking care of him. Bruce is taking care of him. You know, the main thing that we see here is that whoever Karma is, he wants to get rid of all the Batman sidekicks because he feels they're making him weaker. And I thought that was such an interesting thing to do based on, you know, the long-running arc or a couple of arcs that Tynion just came out of on Detective Comics. I mean, he was on there for, you know, what, like 40-something issues. Did a fantastic job, by the way. And a lot of it was about legacy, right? About having teams of people that can help Batman. And what this new villain is saying is, you know, you don't need any of that. Batman was great when it was just Batman. And maybe like the one Robin. I want to see how that plays out, because Robin was in Batman from very, very early on. But, you know, what makes you great is you, Batman, not all these kids. He's like, you're diluting the brand. You know, you're giving your symbol to all these kids who don't know how to use it. And I want to see how that plays forward, because I thought that was so interesting to have it happen at this point in time. And I think it's a perfect change of pace for this book. So we'll see. It's pretty obvious to me that the Outsiders will be introduced either in this arc or as a result of whatever happens in this arc, because Black Lightning does show up and he plays a key role here. We have, based on the attack, Bruce calls Martian Manhunter in, and he's trying to figure out how he can get the Justice League's approval to create a new team. And, you know, he talks to Alfred about this a little bit. He talks to Duke, who's still unconscious about it a little bit. And of course he talks to Black Lightning, who is in Metropolis. He's an English teacher and he's doing his Black Lightning thing. And he was really awesome in this issue. Of course, after one of these fights that Black Lightning has, Batman approaches, Black Lightning, and he's like, look, I've got a plane that Bruce Wayne chartered for me. It leaves in 6 hours. I'm going to make a new team. I want you to be the team leader. And Black Lightning is like, I don't want to be a team leader. You know, remember what happened last time? And that was a Dark Knight's reference. You know, Batman's like, look, I don't need somebody who wins every time. I need somebody who knows when they're losing, is pretty much what he said. And I thought that was so interesting because, you know, that's what makes Batman a great character and a great leader, is you need to know when to retreat. And this is something that actually shows up in Man of Steel number 5 as well. But you need to know when to retreat, right? When to reassess the situation and how you can solve it to your advantage. So he feels like Black Lightning is that person. And I guess, you know, obviously this is an arc. So Black Lightning will be coming back and, you know, joining Batman for this journey. There's a few other things on here that are interesting. Cassandra Cain does get attacked by Carmen as well. That's kind of when the issue ends. And that's when we actually get to see what this guy looks like. And the costume's interesting. This is a brand new character created for this arc. You know, we don't know anything about him yet, but I do remember there being a Karma back in the day. Tommy Karma, for the Batman fans, may remember, was a fan of Batman's who was thoroughly obsessed with Batman, who based his whole life around Batman. In fact, he named his daughter Robin, and that was in like Batman 402 is when you had the second Batman. It's that, I mean, I thought it was a pretty cool cover, the cover of Batman fighting Batman. You know, his name was Tommy Karma, so I do wonder if this guy is related. There are some hints in this book that Karma and Batman do have a history, because he does say that Batman saved him at one point. And that is kind of the case in that, with Tommy Karma. So I'm curious to know if it's a brand new villain for sure, or maybe based a little bit on that. I'm okay with it either way. I'm very excited to know how this whole thing wraps up. Detective Comics 983, I thought was absolutely brilliant. I'm going to give this one a 4.5 out of 5. Oh, one thing I didn't mention though, the Outsiders thing. Of course, Black Lightning's in here. He was the team leader of the Outsiders. During the news report, there is a reference to Markovia, which of course is the home of Geoforce and Terra, who were also members of the Outsiders. So I want this Outsider book, and I want Brian Edward Hill to write it. All right, let's go on. Since we're on DC, let's just keep going with it. I just referenced it. Man of Steel number 5. I don't want to go in-depth about this, but there's a few things that I want to say. When this whole Bendis thing was announced, I was a little weary. When Man of Steel number 1 came out, I was not impressed. But I have to say, now that we're 5 issues into this thing, I absolutely love Man of Steel. And I really hope that Bendis can keep up this pace when Superman relaunches and he's doing Superman and action and whatever else he's doing at the same time. I hope he can keep up the pace. I know he's a prolific writer. He's a very masterful writer, so I'm sure he can juggle multiple books. He's done that over at Marvel before. But I hope he can keep up the pace with this book. Man of Steel number 5 is by far one of my favorite of the series. We finally get to learn what the issue is on why we haven't seen Lois and John Kent. There's a person from the past that comes in and wants to take John away. Well, I'm not gonna spoil it, but it's somebody that we know. It's somebody that we've seen recently. And this is not a fight thing. this is very much a family argument. So hopefully that'll give you some hints. I don't want to spoil it because I know some people don't read books for, you know, a week or two afterwards sometimes. But I really dug that whole scene. It made perfect sense as to why maybe Clark and Lois are on the outs at the moment. So I think that was well done because some people were worried that Bendis is going to come in and he's going to undo the marriage. He's going to undo John Kent being his kid. And that seems to not be the case. The story may be going places where some people weren't expecting, but I really, really love the way that it's going. I hope that this John in Space thing does work out though. And I hope it's touched upon within the book itself, maybe in action. A lot of the book also takes place in a fight between Superman and Rogal Zar, which is the new villain that nobody ever knows how to say. The way that the fight scenes are handled, I thought were really interesting. Adam Hughes is the main artist in this book. The whole scene with will John go to space? Will John not go to space? That was Jason Fabok. Of course, it's beautiful. I really love the Adam Hughes stuff. And what I said on Twitter was I want them to put Adam Hughes on a regular Superman book because the art style is so interesting. It's very minimalist. The way he plays with panel layouts are really interesting. Sometimes multiple panels are made into one panel, but it's like a puzzle piece in a way. And I thought it was just beautiful the way it's done. I think the coloring helps a lot also in the Adam Hughes stuff. I think this may not be someone's cup of tea or a lot of people's cup of tea, but it works so well for me. I really love Adam Hughes stuff, and I'm glad to see him in this book. You know, it's a little weird sometimes to have multiple artists in a book or, you know, within each and every issue, but it works really well with this book. And man, like the way Adam Hughes draws this whole thing, I thought was brilliant. It does get very emotional too. Supergirl shows up and tries to help save the day. The Justice League get involved and they find Superman out on the moon. Of course, there's some repercussions on the fallout of what happened to Kandor, and I thought that was really interesting. So overall, this was a brilliant issue. There is action, but a lot of the action is interactions between characters. And some people may find that boring, but it was so interesting to read. So interesting. I think Bendis has really nailed the personalities of all these characters. Of course, I'm still curious to know more about Chief Moore, who's the new fire chief in Metropolis. It's the woman who everyone assumes Clark Kent is having an affair with. Somehow she knows Clark, she knows Batman, she knows a lot of these superheroes, and they kind of make fun of her about that at the firehouse. But she's a very interesting character, and she gives us a more ground-level look at what happens in Metropolis. And I think that works pretty well, you know, a nice juxtaposition to a character like Superman who's all-powerful. And she's just, you know, a firefighter. There is a big reveal at the end of the issue that I'm not going to spoil. But if you have been reading this, you might be aware of what Rogal Zar is trying to do. He wants to kill Superman. He was supposedly responsible for the destruction of Krypton. That definitely plays into play here in a giant reveal at the end of the issue. In a beautiful page, by the way. I would love to have this page, the original art for this page. It's brilliant. Very much enjoy Man of Steel. I think this book is super, super solid. Do not sleep on this book. I think Bendis is doing a fantastic job on his DC stuff right now. And I hope it can go that way going forward. So Man of Steel number 5 is a 5 out of 5. Let's move over to Dark Horse Comics with Bedtime Games number 1. This is up there in one of my favorites of the week. Nick Keller, Connor Nolan, and Kelly Fitzpatrick are the creators on this book. And this is coming in at a perfect time for me. There was a direct quote from an H.P. Lovecraft story in this issue. The dad is reading the kid a bedtime story, and apparently he reads his kid Lovecraft to go to bed. I don't know if I would read my kid's Lovecraft to go to bed, but apparently the kid likes it. Now, this is a horror book. However, there's not a lot of horror in it. And let me say that with a caveat. There's not a lot of supernatural horror stuff in it. There is some stuff when these kids go into this secret door in the mountains and they fall down into a tunnel and they find this bedtime stories pamphlet. There's some eyes in the darkness. There's a character that pops up later on at the end of the book that makes it a horror story. But a lot of the horror in this issue is actually very, very personal and very human horror stories, because the three main kids who we follow through much of the book have very interesting pasts. And not very nice past. Like one of the kids, his brother, I'm assuming has cancer or some other severe condition. And so it's very interesting how his worldview has changed based on that and things that he does and does not do based on his brother. There's a character who has a very shady past with his dad. His dad is very abusive and we don't get to see a whole lot of that, but based on the way he acts, he's very outgoing, very jokey, but he does mention the violence that he has at home. So that was really interesting to see. The main character is African American, or actually mixed, half white, half black. And her story, I thought, was the most interesting. There are some racial things that do pop up, though it's not a huge player. The main thing is that her mom was killed very violently in front of her. In fact, we do see that panel at one point. Her mom used to run a bookshop, and these kids wanted to get some of the rare books and the money, and they went in there. As a result of the whole thing, the mom was basically shot in the head with a shotgun. And how that whole thing has changed her life, because she went to live with her grandma, and her grandma is obviously an alcoholic. Her grandma's very abusive to her, and obviously hated her own daughter because she married a white man. And, you know, there's a lot of really interesting things at play here. So this first issue of Bedtime Games is definitely a setup. And, you know, if you like the Comic Veritas stuff, the slice of life, hateful term, stuff, I think you really dig this. But you also dig it if you want a nice classic horror story, I think, right? Because it does set a lot of these things up. And, you know, the quote-unquote villain that we get at the end, Mr. Bedtime, I don't know what to think of him yet. But I did love the way he was introduced, because when these kids are in this tunnel that they can't get out of, right? Because there's no stairs to get back up. And they do find a way out, but they're in this tunnel, and the girl finds a pamphlet. The pamphlet almost looks like the cover to, like, an old Vault of Horror or Tales from the Crypt thing, which, of course, I really love. And, you know, it just says, "The Nightmare, Mr. Bedtime is here for you," right? And when she looks at it, it's got this Mr. Bedtime character kind of up on the top, putting his arm around the top of the panel, and then there's a beheaded girl in the page. And of course, if you look at it carefully, the beheaded girl looks a whole lot like the main character, which was really interesting. It seems like maybe Mr. Bedtime talks to her out of this page in one of the panels, which is also very interesting. Whether this actually happened or not, we don't know. When she shows the page to some of the other kids, the page looks different. It's still the beheaded girl, but she's kind of in front of a cabin in the woods in a starry sky, and it still says, "Mr. Bedtime is here for you." So it looks like maybe different people see different things in this page. And there's a couple really cool ones. Like when she's walking away, she's holding the page down right as she's walking, so I'm not paying attention to it. And the drawing on the page shifts and becomes creepier, and the figure's like reaching out to grab her. And of course, this page plays a key role in something that happens at the end of the issue when Mr. Bedtime shows up. And I don't want to spoil that either. But I really recommend this book. I thought it was beautifully done. It's extremely personal and emotional and deep. And I really like the level of characterization that we have here. So I very much look forward to see how the rest of the story goes. That is Bedtime Games number 1 from Dark Horse Comics. It's a 5 out of 5. It was brilliant. I loved it. Another horror book from Dark Horse Comics is Blackwood number 2. This is Evan Dorkin, Veronica Fish, and Andy Fish. And of course, I talked about the first issue and I really dug it. And this second one is a lot more straightforward. Things really kick up like 35 notches. The Dean of Students that was killed in the first issue pops back up in here. He's kind of this demon-possessed dead being right now who wants to help Blackwood survive because of an impending threat, but also because he's part of the impending threat now, he wants to kill some of these kids. There's a lot going on in this issue. And I would have to spend a whole lot of time on it to make it make sense. But I like the reveal that we know now what Blackwood is, right? It is a school where they teach, you know, mystical arts and things like that, you know, history, folklore, things like that. But the main reason for the school is to create a team of kids who have potential to have great abilities and use this team to fight threats to our world. And of course, there are four main characters who are basically going to be this team. and they get the most reveals out of anybody, even though there's a lot of kids in the school right now. Some of them are getting sent home because, you know, people are dying, and they're blaming it on, like, a gas leak, just like, you know, every time it's what it is, right? Like a gas leak or, I don't know, whatever, radion in the ground, who knows? So some of these kids are getting sent home, but the team is there, and they're made fully aware of everything. They learn about the history of the school. They learn about all these artifacts. I like, by the way, they go into the basement and they find like a two-headed monkey who looks like a stuffed doll, but he actually is a real thing and attacks them. Really cool, really well done. I'm extremely surprised how well Veronica Fish's art works for this book. You know, I'm more familiar with her stuff from like the Archie stuff that she was doing, but it works really well here. And this is almost like a darker version of the Scooby Gang without Scooby-Doo. And I think that's what I like about it, because even though it's a horror book and there's a lot of crazy, zany things happening, it's full of humor and full of personality. You know, it's not an extremely dark and deep read. There's very dark moments in this book, but it's also very fun. And that's nice to see in a horror book. I don't know if I would say this is all ages, but I think it does appeal to a wider range of readers than some of the other horror stories that I've talked about on this podcast. So I really dig this. I don't know how much more I want to say about it, because talking about the story really spoils a lot of it. But I definitely recommend picking up Blackwood from Dark Horse Comics. This is another 5 out of 5. All right, let's do the last book. We're going back to Marvel. And I know I can hear it already. There's a couple of you groaning because the last book I'm talking about is Multiple Man number 1. From Marvel Comics. This is Matt Rosenberg, Andy McDonald, Tamara Von Villain, and Travis Lanham, with covers by Marcus Martin, or Marcus Martin, however you want to say it. And I love this book so much. I really did. Now, some of you Marvel fans may remember that Multiple Man died very early on, kind of almost off-panel, in Death of X, which was last year, I think. And he died. And so when they announced this book, some of you were like, well, how is he coming back? He's dead. And then you figured, oh, it's going to be some stupid thing because it's Marvel and they kill people and it doesn't matter because he always comes back. Well, guess what? Multiple Man is dead. He is. What we see here is one of Multiple Man's multiples, I guess is what we call him. So after the whole thing of the battle and Death of X, some of the X-Men found this clone or multiple of Multiple Man, Jamie Hunt Madrix. And brought him back to the mansion, or wherever they're stationed now, and to have Beast look at him and see if they can figure out what's wrong with him. As it turns out, the clone wakes up, and he says, no, yeah, like, Jamie's dead. He's like, I'm the ghost of Jamie. And they're like, what the hell, you don't look a ghost? And he's like, okay, I'm one of the duplicates. You know, Jamie is dead, I'm one of the duplicates, you know, every time. So Multiple Man's power is basically, if he hits something really hard, he splits into two. And during one of the battles in Death of X, he formed multiples of himself, and one of them survived, and that's this guy. And so there's a lot of really interesting things to say about this book in terms of what makes a person a person. You know, you could bring this into clones or like AI if you wanted to. I think the part of the problem that some people are having with this book is some of the really interesting ethical ramifications of what this book is about get kind of glossed over because the book is very fun. And Jamie is written extremely comedic. I think Rosenberg does that very well, based on the fact that he's been an indie writer for so long and now doing stuff at Marvel. He's bringing some of that sensibility in. And, you know, at first I thought I wouldn't like a comedic book because I usually hate those kind of things. Like, I don't read Deadpool or Harley Quinn or those kind of things because it's just, I don't like it. The over-the-top, the constant funny stuff, it doesn't work for me. But I think there was enough here where I did not mind the funny stuff. And in fact, I really enjoyed the funny stuff because it leads to some quirky situations that aren't necessarily over-the-top. Basically, this Jamie Maddox dupe, I think he's still going by Jamie, I don't know. Everyone calls him Jamie. He's, you know, recuperating, he's talking to the different X-Men, and he decides he's got a plan, and he's going to try to fix this whole thing. Now, what that plan is, we don't know, but his plan is very simple. He wants to find Bishop, take Bishop's time device, and travel through time to solve the problem. Well, as all this happens, immediately there's an alarm at, you know, the headquarters, a portal opens up, and Jamie pops out, except it's not Well, it's the same Jamie, but it's not the same Jamie because he's traveled through time. And, you know, to Beast, it's been like 10 or 15 minutes since the original thing when he was brought in. But to Jamie, it's been a long time, years maybe. When that happens, another Jamie pops out of the portal and tackles this one Jamie. And, you know, part of Multiple Man's thing is he can reabsorb all his dupes. And that happens here after they have one of these fights. And it seems like it may be painful for some of them. We don't know if this new Jamie dupe is good or bad, but, you know, the whole X-Men come in. Bishop's extremely mad because, you know, his time device gets stolen. Of course, Jamie's like, look, that was such a long time ago. And Bishop's like, look, it was literally 7 minutes ago. They take Jamie into the library and Jamie starts telling him the story of, you know, kind of why he did what he did, whether he should be alive or not, you know, what it, again, we go back to that thing, right? What it means to be a clone. How can we talk about memories and experiences when you're not that same person? Or are you that same person? And again, not something that was discussed a whole lot here, but I hope that Rosenberg can bring some of that stuff in as we go forward. Immediately after this, though, we have a Deadpool that pops in through the window that looks very Rob Liefeldian. And this is when I said, oh no, please don't put Deadpool in this book. Luckily, they did not put Deadpool in this book. And I'm going to spoil this part. There are characters that show up that are not who they seem to be. So this Deadpool is not actually Deadpool. He's got these psychic claws coming out of his hands, which I thought was cool. He's got little pouches on his chest, which look like the Multiple Man symbol, which was interesting when I first saw it. And he starts fighting the X-Men. Then we have this Bishop character that comes in. He's also got the Multiple Man symbols on his chest. And he's very much a Cable that's been taken over by the techno-organic virus. He's fighting the X-Men. We have this, like, Sorcerer Supreme-looking guy that pops in. And he's fighting the X-Men. And, oh, he's not Sorcerer Supreme. He looks more like Cloak from Cloak and Dagger. Maybe that's what it is. Because at one point, we see the Hulk pop out from underneath the guy's cloak. And they're like, oh my god, he brought a Hulk. And the Hulk's also got the Multiple Man symbol on his chest. And they're all fighting. And finally, Jamie's like, oh my god, this sucks. Everyone, please just stop what you're doing. And the fight stops. And then it's revealed. Cloak guy pulls off his cloak. Deadpool takes off his mask. And we see that they're all different versions of Jamie Maddox with these abilities of other mutants and other creatures. And that was interesting. I want to know what the origin of that is. Whether that's actually true. How they were able to achieve these powers. But really interesting concept. And I can't wait to see what the next issue is about. It's so quirky and different. And I'm surprised Marvel is letting Rosenberg tell this kind of story. I know I talked to Ronnie quite a bit about this. Ronnie hated this book. And I understand why. You know, I think Ronnie is still very much about the Peter Byrne stuff from X-Factor. I totally get that. You know, those iconic runs like, you know, Byrne or Claremont and stuff like that. It's hard to beat, especially if that's what you were reading when you were reading comics in the beginning, when you were younger. But I think this is really fun, and I think it'll appeal to a lot of people. So Multiple Man number one, I thought was brilliant, and I can't wait for the rest of it. I think I'm going to rate this one a 5 out of 5, too. That's going to be the end of this episode. Thank you all for listening. Tomorrow, I will be back with the news, and there are some news to talk about. I will not be talking about Batman 50. I'm going to save the Batman 50 talk to Thursday when I have my guest on. I know he's got some things to say about it, but we'll be talking about that then. There is quite a bit of news to talk about. Disney, Fox deal may be finally at an end, so I'll definitely be talking about that. Wednesday, I want to do some listener questions, so if you have any, reach out to me at GeekVine on Twitter. You can email nerdlegion@gmail.com, and I will answer those on Wednesday. So full week this week. 5 episodes again, most likely. Thank you all for listening. I'll catch you then.